Coleman National Monument in Chicago, Illinois, with your host, Dr. Lynn Hughes.
We welcome you to Live from the Pullman National Monument, our global cast magazine format talk radio show, where we discuss all things culturally economic development, i.e. tourism, and we hold informative conversations on the arts, music, business, and people. I'm your host, Dr. Lynn Hughes, founder of the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porta Museum, a National Park Service site in Chicago, Illinois. Good day to you, my listening audience, and we thank you for joining us. Stay with us. In the tradition of this program, Live from the Pullman National Monument, we've established coming on explaining to you, the listening audience, about the Pullman National Monument. Because the Pullman National Monument is so new, there's still lots of questions about it. What is it? Where is it? What are the boundary lines? And what does it actually mean, since it is the first national park in the city of Chicago? Well, the Pullman National Monument is different from most national monuments in that it is not just a single building. The Pullman National Monument is a thematic district. The themes for the Pullman National Monument are labor and architectural history. The town is famous for its Queen Anne 18th century, 19th century architecture. The town was built by George Pullman, who was the owner, creator, founder of the Pullman Railcar Company. Mr. Pullman built the town for the people who worked for him, well, most of the people who worked for him. He built the town to provide housing for the people who worked in the factory. They were carpenters, cabinet makers, machinists, that kind of thing. And he wanted to build housing for them because he wanted to ensure that they had a place to live that was close to his factory, in that he was a very astute businessman. And so providing housing for his employees that was steps from his factory meant that he could always count on his employees being at work and on time. But Mr. Pullman had two categories of employees. He had those employees that I just named for you, and he also had African American railroad employees who were the onboard crew for the Pullman Railcar Company. They did not live in the Pullman Company because they were African Americans, and because of the racial climate and conditions of that time, they could not live in Pullman. So the people who worked as the onboard crew for the Pullman Company lived in a community in the city of Chicago known as Bronzeville. So the connection for African Americans to the Pullman National Monument is that they worked for the company that was located in the Pullman National Monument. But the recognition for the people who were working for the Pullman Company as the onboard crew, most specifically the ones that the claim to fame are the one that brought the most distinction, and those who created history with the Pullman Company were the Pullman Porters, who later became known as the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. They were the formulators of the first African-American labor union in the country. They were the first to win a collective bargaining agreement with a major U.S. corporation, which happened to be the Pullman Company. And so that is the significance for labor history for the Pullman community, or the Pullman National Monument. Most specifically, it is the Black labor history connection for the Pullman National Monument. President Barack Obama designated the Pullman National Monument, the community of Pullman, as a Pullman National Monument in February of 2015. And so we are basically catching up, if you will. There were a number of entities. We were already here, already doing what we do, each of us in our own respective niches, before President Obama designated the area. Case in point, there is the Historic Pullman Foundation, who operates a house tour, an annual house tour. And they have been doing that, I believe, for 40 years. And it is well attended, well established, and quite successful. They are housed at the Pullman Visitor Center, that is at 111th and Cottage Grove. Then there is the Pullman Factory, which is most famously referred to as the Pullman Clock Tower. That is the building that was the site of the Pullman Factory, where they actually made the train cars, and it was the offices of the Pullman Company. They are also at 111th and Cottage Grove. That particular property is now owned by the state of Illinois and has been, I believe, for maybe 10 years. But that building is not open to the public on a daily basis. You visitors may go to that factory and tour the building by appointment only. The Historic Pullman Foundation, which is at 112th and Cottage Grove, is currently shared with, or shared by, the National Park Service and the Historic Pullman Foundation. The National Park Service is currently working on building or building out their visitor center, which will become the official visitor center for the Pullman National Monument, and it will be physically located in the Pullman Clock Tower. But until they finish, they are currently sharing the space at the Pullman Visitor Center, which is at 112th and Cottage Grove. I'm not sure what the name is going to be once they finish, because you won't be able to have two visitor centers, but that is where they are physically operating out of now. Then you have the Hotel Florence. It was the hotel that was in place for people who came to visit Pullman. It is now under construction, and we are still not clear what that's going to be. You can visit that as well by appointment only. Then there is the Greenstone Church. The Greenstone Church has a history. Its significance is that is because the bricks are green limestone that was distinctive at the time, and apparently it still is. That's number one. The second thing is because of the organ that is there, which apparently has major significance. And then, of course, there's the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, of which I happen to have the honor of being the founder. It is a 22-year-old African-American labor history museum. And while it is small in size, the historic significance has national acclaim in that it is the first African-American labor history in the U.S. It is the only one of its kind worldwide, and it has been in operation for 2 years, and the museum is open Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from 11 to 4, and the admission is $5. I make a point of saying that because all of the buildings that I named in this discussion are owned by the state or the federal government, and so they do not charge an admission because they don't have to. We're not in that capacity yet. We do not have a written agreement with the federal government that would allow us to have a free admission, but we're working on it. We have one new restaurant. It's called the Pullman Cafe. It is at 113th and Champlain. So I hope that that is provides you, the listening audience, with the kind of information that you need for your visiting of the Pullman National Monument. Each of the entities that I made reference to has their own individual websites, and you can follow them. But of course, you can visit the A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, and the information that I have provided for you is displayed there on each entity under Pullman National Monument. So I hope that that provides you with information that you need that will help better help you understand what's going on with the Pullman National Monument. We are going to take a quick break and come right back with our first guest.
Visit the PullmanPorterMuseum.com, where you can purchase an annual membership at the level of your choice. And of course, visit our website here to find out more about the show live from the Pullman National Monument at bbsradio.com/live from PNM to contact us.
Back and welcome to another edition of Around the Museum Table. Our guest today is Rebecca Karsher. She is Chief of Interpretation and Education and Cultural Resource Management at the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta, Georgia. And we are thrilled to have her today. And by the way, that is a National Park Service site. Just wanted to throw that in. A fellow National Park site colleague. We're very pleased and proud to have her join us today. So, Rebecca, welcome to the show.
It's good to be here. Good afternoon.
So, I'm so excited about having you as our guest today. Our president, Mr. Peterson, was in Atlanta and met you, and he just couldn't stop talking about the King Center and the wonderful people that he had met, and you were among those people. And I was just in such a hurry to get you on the show today because we're new in the community of national parks, and so we have been very fortunate to meet people, whether it be on the phone or whether it be in person, and this was a gift. So I'm just very interested in having you sort of just, this is a very informal environment. And so one of the things at this show live from the Pullman National Monument, our focus is 100% tourism. And because we are an internet talk radio show, it gives us the opportunity to have a national and an international audience. And so for all of those people who are traveling around the world and who have the opportunity to come to America and the United States, they have an opportunity to visit some of the wonderful cultural sites that we have, museums and national parks and monuments and the like. So we like to expose those sites in those categories, so that when we have people to visit, they can know before they get there what they're going to see, or they can have it on their things to do list of places, must see places. And so I know that the King Center is a must see, a must visit place. And so I think that I would love to have you to talk about maybe the number of visitors that you have and the kinds of things that people can see and experience when they come to the King Center.
Sure. Well, the Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site consists of the 38 historic structures that we have in the park. Most of those historic structures are rented out to the general public, And that helps us preserve the property, because when a house is occupied, it's easier to maintain it, especially historic structures. And we have basically a bidding system for leasing, and the general public can apply to live in the units. And that helps us maintain Auburn Avenue to look like it's the historic structures and houses make Auburn Avenue look like it did when Dr. King lived here in the 1930s. So it's really exciting. It's like stepping back in time to the 1930s. We have the row houses, which are small one bedroom basically houses. And then we also have large units as well, which are two floors, many, many different bedrooms. And the King house was a multi-generational household. Dr. King lived there with his parents and his grandparents, and it has two stories and four bedrooms. And we have offer tours of the birth home, which are very popular. We offer tours every day, guided tours every day. Those tours are our tickets for those tours are free, and the tickets are given out at the visitor center located at 450 Auburn Avenue, northeast in Atlanta, Georgia. And we allow about 17 people on the tour, and you have to sign up for it in the morning. Normally, it sells out by lunchtime. And we typically offer tours at 10, 11, 2, and 4. On the weekends, sometimes we offer additional programs at 12 and 3. And on Friday mornings for Black History Month and for Women's History Month, we're having open house tours from 10 to 12, where people have the opportunity to walk through the house without receiving a guided tour, but it lets more people see the house. Now, only the first floor of the house is currently open because the second floor is being assessed. We had an issue with the flooring on the first floor. Once again, one of our biggest jobs we do is preserve historic homes. And the home is, the birth home is over 100 years old. It was built in the 1890s. And, of course, when it was built, it wasn't built to receive the thousands of visitors to receive every day. So basically the first floor of the house, the floor gave out. So we just repaired the floor and reinforced the floor with steel beams. But we had to look at the second floor to assess it to make sure it's safe, because we certainly, don't want any issues with the second floor, because it's a safety issue. So we're in the process of assessing the second floor in a complete home, and rehabilitation. And we also have the Ebenezer Baptist Church that people can visit, which is Dr. King's spiritual birth home. Dr. King's maternal grandfather, A.D. Williams, started the home. He started the church in 1904. And then when Martin Luther King Sr. Married into the family, he became the co-pastor of the church. And then Martin Luther King, and then A.B. Williams died, and then Martin Luther King Jr. became the pastor. So it's a multi-generational family church and house. And then we also have the visitor center. And at the visitor center, we have a movie and we have exhibits to talk about the civil rights movement and Dr. King. So it's a lot to see. We get about 800,000 visitors a year. And we get visitors from all over the world. Today we just had a special program for Black History Month. And the ranger was telling me that he had people on the tour from Nigeria and from Alabama and from Wisconsin. I mean, we get people from every corner of the globe come here because they want to be inspired about the life and legacy of Dr. King. And that's one of the exciting things about working here is a just such diverse group of visitors, all who, want to learn about Dr. King and are motivated by his message.
Okay. That is some very valuable and interesting information. And I say that because we at the Pullman National Monument are experiencing a very similar occurrence at the A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. And that is that over the last year, the international visitorship has increased tremendously. And we have had people, particularly folks from the UK, from London in particular, they seem to be very, very interested in Black labor history and the civil rights movement, because at our place they sort of they converge the two because it's so similar. And so I think that it's very interesting how that in America we are experiencing an influx of interest in Black labor history and the civil rights movement. So that's good to know. That it's interesting to note, actually, that that is happening not just at our place, but around the country. But that's a good thing, because the more you know about other cultures, the more you know about the people. And that has a direct impact on relations, race relations, and human relations. So
sure.
It does. I'm sorry, I kept going on and on, but I have a tendency to do that. So go right ahead, Rebecca.
No, I just wanted to say that I would say that the most common foreign visitors would be Spanish, as far as language speaking, would be Spanish, Chinese, German, and then maybe Japanese and French, but definitely Spanish, German, and Chinese. We get a lot of Chinese visitors, a lot of Spanish visitors, and people from all over the world. I mean, Israel, you know, every corner of the globe, you name it, they come here.
I suspect that that's a very interesting position that you have. You have an opportunity to be exposed to these different cultures and people from around the globe who seem to be interested in civil rights. I suspect that is very rewarding. It is for me to know that.
Yeah.
And it's encouraging to know that people are interested in different cultures. You're so inundated with, when you watch the news, it's very discouraging. But then when you have an opportunity to have people from around the globe come to your site, it does give you it does give you hope. I heard what you said about, you know, you were naming the different cultures and the different languages. I want to say maybe it was about 2 months ago, we had a tour bus of 70 people, and they were all Chinese. Well, we weren't sure, because, I mean, we just weren't sure if they were Chinese or Japanese. But they came and they thoroughly enjoyed the visit. They had an interpreter. Some of them spoke English, but about half of them did not. And our director has developed a practice that whenever we have people from different countries, he always makes this little short video that the young people do. I think they call it some image or whatever they do on the social media. Steve, what they so, but they made this video, and they made the video in their own language. We could feel the excitement and the sincerity and the enthusiasm that came across from that video. But we had no idea what they were saying. And so about 2 weeks after that, we had an intern who came from the University of Chicago to do an interview about our museum. And she happened to be Chinese. And so I said to her, I don't know how the subject came up, but when she said where she was from, I said, oh, you're Chinese. And I quickly grabbed the video that was on the on our phone and let her and play it for her. And I said to her, can you tell me what they are saying? And she said, oh, they were so excited and so happy that they came. And they said they learned so much and they want to recommend the museum to other people. That made me feel so good, because it says that we are doing a good job in our interpretation. And so I suspect that you encounter that same kind of feeling. It's very rewarding.
Very much so, yes.
So Rebecca, do you have anything that you want to share about anything particular that's going on in case we have global visitors who are descending upon Atlanta who maybe hadn't thought about coming, but maybe something you can say that will encourage them to come?
Well, for the spring, we have a few special programs. We have in February, it's Black History Month. And every Friday, as I said, we have open house tours. They can come to visit the birth home without it, then they won't need a ticket. We also have on Friday afternoons, we have facilitated dialogue sessions where people talk about their experiences of what Dr. King means to them. And that's a very interesting program. That's going to be in the fire station. And then February is very, very, very busy for us for school groups. And then in March, we have also the open house tours on Fridays. And then we're going to have storytelling for children where on Thursdays, where the students can learn about women in the movement. Remembrance Day is on April 4th. That's the day that Dr. King was assassinated. April of 2018 is a good time to come because it's going to be a lot of commemorative activities from April 4th to April 9th. April 9th is the day that Dr. King came back home and his funeral service was in the Ebenezer Baptist Church at 10 o'clock on April 9th. And the clock in the historic church is set at 10 o'clock when the church service ended. So, and then in May, we have the International Rose Peace Garden Ceremony, where children from around the world write about what peace means to them and what Dr. King means to them. And the winners of it's a poetry contest, and the winners receive a recognition at the International Rose Peace Garden commemorative ceremony. And that's going to be on May 10th this year.
I bet that's going to be exciting for the kids. I'm sure they won't be able to contain themselves being able to have that kind of exposure. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's wonderful. I'd say that's my favorite. I mean, there's so many great events, but that's my favorite event of the whole year because the kids get to read the poems. And it's just fantastic. It's so inspiring. All this information is on our website, www.nps.gov/MALU. Also, our Facebook page is really great. I know Facebook these days can be stressful with all the politics on it, but there's there's still some good sites that are educational on Facebook, and I encourage you to check out our site. Our site is to go into Facebook and you type in Martin Luther King Jr. National Historic Site, because we have a lot of, we also advertise our programs on our Facebook page, and we're also on Twitter as well. And in the summer months, we'll probably be doing open house tours as well, probably on Friday and Saturday mornings. So it's, we're always busy, which is good. For everybody who works here is enthusiastic about serving the public. We all care a great deal about the park and about Dr. King's legacy. And we're here to serve the public, and we all take a lot of pride in that.
Well, this was very informative and inspiring. Rebecca, we thank you so very much for taking the time to do our program today and to share this information about a wonderful cultural resource. So, yes. And we hope that you'll come back again and visit us as the summer comes along. Maybe you can come back and share some new information with us. So we love having you, and thank you very much. So Rebecca Karcher, everybody, Chief of Interpretation, Education, and Cultural Resource Management at the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta, Georgia. Once again, Rebecca, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and come back. Our next guest is Mr. David Peterson, President and Executive Director of the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Hughes.
And we're going to let Mr. Peterson share with you some of the wonderful things that are happening, some of the fantastic plans that are being implemented and that are still, in fact, on the drawing table. Why don't you share with our listening audience some of the exciting things you have the opportunity to be a part of, and also they have the opportunity to help initiate there at the Pullman National Monument under the banner of the Randolph Stream Community Development Corporation.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. Well, with Randolph's Dream, our mission basically is to foster the development and activity of cultural economic development within the boundaries of Pullman National Monument and eventually outside, but our focused area right now is Pullman National Monument, specifically because we're focused on tourism as that means of social and economic development. So what we've been doing more than anything lately is focusing on that person-to-person relationship building, you know, building a sense of community, specifically on the northern end of the monument district, where it has not been as present as it could and should have been. Now, for several years, at least 22, to be exact, there has been a lot of activity as far as community development, starting out with an organization called Historic North Pullman. You know, now we have Pullman CDC. We have a couple of new initiatives that have just sparked. United Pullman is a new organization coming around. But all of these things are all of these organizations are basically focused on creating the same sense of community that the South End has in Pullman. We admire that sense of community that they have and have been fostering for some time. And some of us have that same like-minded spirit. However, our focus right now is basically getting everyone else in the community as inspired as we ourselves are. They're unfortunately just as a different culture. So, you know, all of these things are very important. Because once again, they build this sense of community. Now, once we've built this sense of community, we have everyone together. Now, what is the issue? Now we have a pot, if you will, of issues that we need to address. Because all of these different people have different personalities and different things going on in their personal household. Unfortunately, in our community, the narrative usually starts and ends with poverty, a lack of resources that give them the same quality of life that most of our neighbors have. With that being said, it's our duty to think of that first and foremost because we're dealing with people and not machines and take that into consideration. You know, so we believe that culture is the cure. And that's why we have strategically aligned ourselves at the feet of the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum because they serve as our cultural grounding base, if you will. They are what keep us connected to what most CDCs and other organizations don't have, and that's a sense of a responsibility to preserve and interpret our history, heritage, and culture. With that, it gives us the blueprint of what to do and what not to do because it has been done either right or wrong in the past. And with that being said, you know, we focus all of our things around those two areas. Once again, history, heritage, and culture, and cultural economic development.
I think it's an excellent explanation. I think it provides a framework for the listeners to understand because as we talk about tourism and as we talk about cultural economic development, that is a relatively new concept for the general public, but cultural economic development has been around a long time. It is just the average person has not connected with or been tuned into or has been properly informed about the concept of cultural economic development. But it's been around as long as tourism has been around, but the general public has this notion or the misperception that tourism again. I said this at the top of the show, that people's concept of tourism has to do with like a Disney World or, you know, the different resorts that are around the country. There is that. But there's also how can tourism impact the lives of the people in the communities? Because it doesn't just stop at the downtown areas of the respective cities across the country and beyond the United States, for that matter. You know, that you take a look at places like Brazil, and it's the same issues are there. The same issues. It's like Jamaica. The same issues are there. They just call them something else. But at the end of the day, when you take a look at what just happened with the Olympics in Brazil, you'll kind of grasp what I mean. So your explanation, very detailed and excellent explanation, by the way, I think should provide the listening audience with a better handle on what we're talking about when we say cultural economic development. Fast forward to how can average people benefit without getting consumed by the muck and mire of politics that just screws up everything, and that's another conversation, and so I won't go there. But I think that's an excellent job, and I'd like for you to elaborate more about what you're doing, and you know, with some specificity if you can, so that we all have a better understanding of what's happening, what's planned, and what's coming.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Randolph's Dream Community Development Corporation was founded on. The reason it's called Randolph's Dream, because what he said to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porter on their organizing night, August 25th, 1925.
You're talking about A. Philip Randolph.
That's right, Asa Philip Randolph. What Asa Philip Randolph said at the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car meeting in the Elks Lodge in Harlem, New York, was what this is about is making you master of your economic fate. You know, that is what he said to the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porter, to engage them, to call them into action, to be focused on the economics of the situation. Not so much the social or the civil part of it, but more the economics, which he felt would give them all of those other things that they wanted, being financially free. And that is the same type of freedom that we want to offer, that same aspiration for economic freedom is what we want to offer to our neighborhoods and the residents of the community. Because we want them to feel like, you know, in the face of poverty, you have an opportunity to pull yourself up by the bootstraps by this enormous pot of money that we are now a part of, being a tourism destination. You know, tourism is one of the most impactful economic markets in the world. And we feel that by not taking advantage of that in entirety, we lose a lot, and that is the one thing that stifles that development in regard to politics, because a lot of politicians don't see it from that perspective, because they might not be artsy people, or they might not be necessarily innovative or creative people, but they're politicians or sea holders, if you will. And so they operate from a different perspective. I know this because I have a Bachelor of Science from Florida Agricultural Mechanical University in political science. So in some of our studies, the way that we were trained was more machine-like as far as how the overall system is concerned. Now, unfortunately, the majority of the politicians that we might come in contact with don't necessarily have that education base, so they might have got in office because they know someone or are popular, but they lack that structural training that is needed to even be a good politician. And that hurts us as a community such as Pullman, because we're light years ahead of the norm, you know what I mean? So we can't have a Fred Flintstone operator in a George Jetson arena, if you will. So there are a lot of different opportunities that come financially from this, you know. And just to go specifically, I'll go into that a little later. But just going back to the answer to your question, what we've been doing, we started this summer with our annual parade throughout the neighborhood, our annual Juneteenth celebration. Juneteenth, which is, for those who don't know, the day that the blacks in Texas actually found out that slavery was over. Because there was an email or the news or things of this nature, a lot of people were still held in captivity after that. So it wasn't until the soldiers rode in on the horses and told them on this day, June 19th, in 1865, once again, 2 years after that slavery was over. So we celebrate this, every year just to kind of celebrate that. And we do it with a Mardi Gras style parade throughout the neighborhood, just to engage the community and let them know what we have going on down at the museum and offer them to come out for free. You know, we partner with the Mounted Buffalo Soldiers, the Black Cowboys and Cowgirls, the Crossroads Corvette Club, and we put on a great show. And the Corvette Club chauffeur is the Tuskegee Airmen, some of the original Tuskegee Airmen. So we do this with pride because it just gives them a sense of history. However, it's also an educational ride, if you will, because once again, you have living history. You have Tuskegee Airmen, you know what I mean, who were directly impacted by the works of A. Philip Randolph. You have the Buffalo Soldiers, who were the original National Park Rangers. You know what I mean? So all of these historical points tie in together of the thematic representation of our monument and now, you know, inclusion into the National Park Service. In addition to that, we had a commemorative event for the Great Migration Centennial, which we're celebrating this year. You know, as you know or don't know, this is the 100th year celebration and anniversary of the Great Migration, the beginning of the Great Migration. So in 1916, you had 7 million blacks come from the south to the north, and 500,000 of that 7 million came to Chicago. So this is where we began to see, you know, a different wave of people coming to Chicago. So this migration period took place from 1916 to 1970 in three different waves. So we have all of these people who've come here, and they've been living here since and impacted this city, you know, culturally, economically, socially, you know, any way you can think of it. So it's important that we continue to tell this story in a thematic manner so that our youth and young adults will know it and be able to continue that story as it goes on. And we were proud to have been able to partner with the Pullman Porter Museum and their youth and young adult division called Museum 44, where hip-hop meets history, as they recently partnered with After School Matters to provide 16 jobs in the North Pullman community this summer. You know, that was a glorious event and a wonderful opportunity, and it gave us an opportunity to economically empower our youth, you know, beyond words. There was a partnership made with Urban Partnership Bank where the kids could open up a bank account there or cash their checks for a lower rate. And this is something that we're glad to be able to influence in our youth coming up now because, you know, students from the age of 14 to 18, primarily coming from low-income families, single-parent families, or just urban families, you know, who are still impacted by the same social ills that, you know, everyone is impacted by, were able to get a job this summer where that job description was basically to learn about their history, heritage, and culture and learn how to create what we call a deliverable, which is something that they can show to their friends, their peers, their parents, and everyone else of what it is that they think about something. So now these kids have the capability, they learned a skill this summer. They have the capability to tell stories and document stories from their narrative. So we want to train them to not necessarily depend on someone else to tell their narrative, because if they leave it up to someone else, it will be exaggerated and excluded, as it always is. You know, so many people are worried about what's going on in the city, as they should be. But however, while they're spending all of their attention on that, they're missing out on the wonderful things that are happening.
Well, that's an excellent point, particularly because I know that people all over the United States and the world, for that matter, are tuned in to Chicago when they talk about the violence that's in Chicago. But Chicago is a wonderful city, and there's a lot more going on than violence. It is just that the media, unfortunately, because that's their business is sensationalism and news, and so they understandably focus right in on the violence. But I'm so happy that you have provided that information or shared that information to the listening audience so that people all over the country and the world can hear and understand and be made aware of that there are a lot more interesting things happening in Chicago than is perpetuated, on the news. One of the things that's really important is because at the A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum, we have a tremendous amount of international visitors. We have people from Europe, from the UK, all parts of the UK. We have people from London, from the Netherlands. We have people from Greece and just all Japan, those kinds of things. And so people would think, outside looking in, people would never imagine that we have international visitors coming to an urban area to learn about and to visit sites under the banner of tourism about Black history, heritage, and culture. And it's safe. They have a wonderful time. They're very well informed. And when they leave, they are overwhelmed with what they have learned. And so I am thrilled that you made a point of sharing some of the information, because people don't get how all of these things are connected, and they are. They're connected, and people just separate things out and compartmentalize things, and they don't understand that it's really all connected. I really would like for you to share now some, if you have any statistical information on some of the things that you talk about. I think that would help also to inform our listening audience on what you're talking about. Do you have that information available, or do you have them on top of your head that you could share with us?
Oh, absolutely. And I pride myself on having access to this type of information, because one of my classes in my undergraduate study, our budget and fiscal management class, our teacher used to always say, you know, in God we trust, everyone else bring data. So, you know, nobody cares what you feel or what you heard. We want to know the data. We want to know the specific numbers that deal with what it is that you're talking about. So a lot of our information that we've been retrieving with Randolph's Dream Community Development Corporation this first year, and as we've been organized, is specifically that. We made it a point to basically just try our best to brand ourselves, but more than anything, acquire the data needed in order to be effective in this region, in this market. So we're partners with Choose Chicago, and we've had an opportunity to go to their event where they basically unleashed their annual report. And with that annual report comes a great deal of data that deals with tourism in the state of Illinois, in Chicago specifically. And, you know, these numbers will blow your mind, because there is a trend in evolving tourism numbers in the city of Chicago. And it's been going on since about 2010. And, I mean, it's just consistently went up. Like, the total tax revenue in 2010 was $616.2 million. This is total tax revenue. In 2015, it was $926.5 million, right? So the Chicago hotel tax revenue was $67.7 million in 2010. In 2015, it was $124.1 million. Now, the overall hotel revenue was $1.5 billion in 2010. 2015, it was $2.2 billion. So you see a direct, you know, uprising of numbers. And now direct tourism spending was $11.1 billion in 2010. 2015, $14.8 billion. The jobs created through tourism, economic impact in 2010, 124.4 thousand. In 2015, 137.9. Once again, you see how it's coming. Now, as far as people who are coming here, you might think, oh, well, it's so bad there. People aren't coming anymore. Well, in 2010, the total visitation was 39.33 million. In 2015, 51.83 million.
My goodness. Domestic
visitation, and this was the total for 2015. We're talking about 50.38 million. Now, international, we had 1.45 million. All right? So in the U.S., by overseas visitors, we're the 10th most visited city. You know, and these are the types of numbers that the normal, like you said, Joe Schmo, might not know about, or might not even care about, because they don't necessarily see how that impacts them. Because when they think about tourism, don't think about the far south side of Chicago from 103rd to 115th Street, Cottage Grove to the expressway. They don't look at this as a tourism destination because it hasn't been marketed and packaged like one until now. And that's why vehicles like Live from Pullman National Monument, the Pullman are so important, because it gives people, the regular person who's not invited to those boardroom discussions, the opportunity to understand exactly what's going on. So beyond that, you know, so now we take all that into consideration. And we also take into consideration what's going on in the urban community just in general. There's something called the micro market recovery zone, which ironically, specifically, North Pullman is a part of. So you have North Pullman, you have Rosemore, and you have Roseland a part of this, right? North Pullman, where the median income is $18,159. You know, median household income. No, that's disposable income. I'm sorry about that. The median household income is $29,215. So as you see, we have low income, very low income people in this community that really, really could take advantage of this and should be able to take advantage of this. And, you know, this is important because in North Pullman, you have 98% of those people are African-American. Now, this doesn't exclude our friends and neighbors down on the south end. This is just our narrative where we see that the deprivation is more dense in this area. So, of course, we're focused on it because that is where the social and economic development really needs to be. And this will easily make the entire community better. You know, so once we get the north end up to speed, if you will, with the southern end, there'll be this invisible Mason-Dixie line, if you will, in our community in 2016.
You know, I think that the information that you just shared, people are probably, their heads are exploding once they heard those numbers, because it is mind-boggling that those kinds of dollars are existing and derived from the wonderful umbrella of tourism, which is what we've been talking about for 20 years, 20 plus years. Tourism is the last bastion of economic development, where ordinary people can get in and benefit from. And it is my hope against hope that the information that we are able to provide to listeners through this vehicle that's made available to us at BBS Radio, Live from the Pullman National Monument, has made available to the ordinary person. It could not have come at a better time. And again, the Pullman Messenger magazine is something that was never had before by people in the community. And of course, the base is the National A. Philip Randolph Pullman Porter Museum. And I just hope that people will want to learn more about the museum, visit the museum, and visit the website, learn more about it at PullmanPorterMuseum.com. You will be surprised. The museum is a 21-year-old cultural institution that is not funded. Did you hear me, listening audience? Not funded by city, state, or federal funds, but has been operated for 21 years through an entrepreneurial model. And so that is why we know tourism works. That is why we know this model works. And so I'm just going to be shamelessly plugging the museum, because we want you to go to PullmanPorterMuseum.com. We operate on the memberships and a traveling exhibit that we have that tours nationally. And that is how we are able to sustain the museum and have it operate. The Pullman National, the Pullman Messenger is a product that we have in collaboration with Hughes Peterson Publishing. And so the good people like United Auto Workers Local 551 and the Hughes Peterson Publishing, I'm going to just do some shameless commercials right here. Hughes Peterson Publishing published a book called An Anthology of Respect, the Pullman Porter's National Historic Registry. It is available on Amazon.com. The Pullman Messenger that covers arts, music, business, and people is available at www.thepullmanmessenger.com. Go there, purchase a subscription. Go on Amazon.com and purchase an anthology of respect, the Pullman Porter's National Historic Registry. All of those things help the museum, and that is how you can help. And continue to listen to Live from the Pullman National Monument. Mr. Peterson, we cannot thank you enough for sharing this valuable information with us. Thank you to our sponsors. Thank you to our engineers, Stephen Mata and Don Newsom, our producer, Keisha Shavers, and of course, BBS Radio Network, for enabling us to use this platform to talk about something that we love, tourism. And lastly, I want to give a big thanks to Jonathan Fritzen, smooth jazz musician who allows us to use his music for our show every single week. So everybody, thank you to the listening audience, because without you, there would be no show. I'm grateful for the opportunity to do this show for you every week. And we'll see you next time on Live from the Pullman National Monument.
Live from Pullman National Monument was brought to you by Hughes Peterson Publishing in Chicago, Illinois. Hosted by Dr. Lynn Hughes.